Tuned in to the First Few Moments podcast, a production of EMS Radio. The First Few Moments podcast is the most up-to-date source for responder best practice discussions and incident review. Join industry leaders and seasoned providers at firstfewmoments.com. You can talk to us through Twitter at First Few Moments, email us at podcast@firstfewmoments.com, or call us 716-245-5FFM. Safety, management, triage, care. Hello and welcome, everybody, to the First Few Moments podcast, your bi-weekly podcast about managing your scene, where we discuss safety, management, triage, and care. My name is Kyle David Bates, and I'm here today to talk to you about triage. Yes, that word we all like to hear, triage. And no, this is not a repeat episode from earlier where we talked about the CDC triage guidelines and where to take patients. We're actually going to talk about sorting our patients, tagging them, walking around with a little can of spray paint, of yellow spray paint, spraying it on their forehead. Don't do that. We kind of got this idea of, you know, when we do the course, that not enough people do formal triage. Well, they do it. They show up on scene. They look at the patient and goes, okay, he's important. He's not important. He's important. He's not important. And that's great. But what ends up happening is the next unit in behind them does the same thing. And today we end up having a call where we end up having a head-on in the town. And we had 5 patients that were injured. And we had to go through and triage them and figure out which patients were going to go where, which ones were going to go as priority for our transports. So helping me today to discuss triage is Mr. Chris Kaiser. Chris, how are you?
I'm doing great this evening. Thanks for having me on. Triage is a subject that's near and dear to my heart, so I'm happy to be on with such a distinguished panel this evening.
Excellent. Thank you, Chris, for joining us. And from Rochester, New York, Mr. Rick Rosati, how are you?
Great to be back, Kyle, as we're going to try and sort through all this triage information tonight.
Wow. If that's the way tonight's going to go, this could be a long night.
Absolutely.
Sort. And finally, a rather, I'll say, an expert in the area of triage, Dr. Lou Romig.
Well, that's a lot to live up to.
Oh, you wrote a triage.
Well, but I've never had to do it.
Well, you wrote it, though.
Theoretically, maybe.
Yeah, it's kind of funny because it's sometimes wonder if any of us do it. How are you tonight?
I'm doing wonderful. Good to have a second hour of podcasting for tonight with you.
Yes, and since this is, I believe, your first time on The First Few Moments.
Yes.
Why don't you go ahead and give our listeners a little bit of background of yourself?
I am a pediatric emergency physician of more than 20 years practice, and yes, it takes a lot of practice, in Miami, Florida at Miami Children's Hospital. I am an EMS groupie of long standing and have been the pediatric medical advisor for Miami-Dade Fire Rescue for a lot of years, and am the author of the Jumpstart Multi-Casualty Pediatric Triage Tool.
And I got to ask you, since we are talking about triage, why did you come up with Jumpstart, and how did you come up with Jumpstart?
Well, being a good medical advisor for a fire department, when my fire department decided to join with the other fire departments in the area in adopting START as their unified MCI triage tool, I took the training and sat through it, and as a good pediatrician said, how would this apply to kids? And, you know, looking through it, I said, well, from what I know of kids, this probably needs a little bit of modification to really apply to the physiology of kids. So I looked around to see if there was an existing tool, couldn't find anything. So I said, okay, let's take a whack at this and take a stab at modifying START, since it was at that time and still is probably the most commonly used tool in the United States. So I sat down, and it didn't really take me very long to put the modification together. But, you know, it was one of those overnight successes where I had already been working on it for a good 5 or 6 years when 9/11 came along. And then after that, just sort of took off and never thought it would go as far as what it has. Am humbled by the fact that it has gone as far as it has. And always looking for ways to make pediatric triage in the multi and mass casualty setting better. And if that means that Jumpstart is going to go away, then that's going to be what's going to happen. I'll back whatever is best for the kids.
And I think that's definitely, you know, a great thing to look at. And we're going to talk about a lot of different types of triage today, which ones work, which ones don't work. And you mentioned START triage, simple triage and rapid transport for that. And that seems to be pretty much a standard throughout at least the United States.
And in various modifications around the world. However, what we need to realize from the get-go is that neither START nor any of the similar START-type tools out there have been scientifically validated in studies. So we're still working on dogma and what we think may work the best. In fact, you know, there's a growing body of evidence that says that START and START-like tools probably are not very effective and may not even be more effective than using no system at all. Hard to realize that we might have to pull back from something that we've all spent a lot of time and energy investing in as far as a procedure that we get used to. But, you know, when better tools come along, then we really need to look at changing.
And that, you know, I mean, those are good things to look at. And we want to talk about that tonight, because the one thing that we talk about in the first few moments is we're not talking about the, you know, the 20-person bus rollover crash, even though you may come across that. We're talking about, you know, the motor vehicle crash with, you know, 4, 5, 6, maybe 8 patients involved. And when you show up on scene after you've made the roadway safe and after you've established some sort of a scene management system, you need to start figuring out who is our priority patients are. And right now, and Chris, Rick, you know, being our street providers, I don't think that's happening at all, do you?
It's hard to jump into a triage system when, especially where I come from, I'm usually the only paramedic that shows up to a scene. When I get there, there may be a BLS ambulance from another community if I'm responding as the ALS assist, and there may not be. I may be running with my own BLS crew, and usually I'm one of the only paramedics in my immediate area. I have used the START system and the Jumpstart system for many years, and I remember it from the trainings I've had, but it's not something I get to use as often as I'd like to do. It's a wonderful tool, and as she said, it's never been proven, but I think any framework that we use to help guide our decisions and have training that can kick in instead of the chaos of the scene is a good system for us to use.
I'll second that motion. It's always been my contention that anything that can help us to pull a little bit of organization out of a chaotic scene can only be better than the chaos. We need to keep in mind when we're talking about these multi to mass casualty triage tools that what my system defines as a multi-casualty where we have to use START and Jumpstart is completely different than maybe Chris's or Rick's scenes. Certainly in Miami-Dade County, what I've got 1,500 to 2,000 EMTs and paramedics in the fire department, and we can do 20, 25 victims on a scene without even thinking about mutual aid or even necessarily doing disaster, quote-unquote disaster-style triage because we've got the resources. Let's always remember that disaster is defined by the resources that are not or are available compared to the patient needs. So, you know, a lot of these calls where we have multi-victim crashes, maybe you don't even need to do disaster-style triage, but it may not also be appropriate to use the kind of triage that you use on an everyday scene.
That's absolutely right. I've worked in a myriad of different systems. I've worked urban systems where we did 20,000 calls a year, and currently I specialize in rural EMS, I like to say. And if we come across a scene that has 4, maybe 5 patients, we've overwhelmed our system with that one scene. Simply because my service has 3 ambulances available within a reasonable amount of time, but our neighbors may not have ambulances available for 20 minutes, maybe a half hour, depending on where the location of the call is. And these systems, I see that I've always liked them because they are generic enough that they've been used between the urban systems that I've worked on, but they still work more or less in the rural systems. it gives us, a framework to go on wherever you may be. And that's why I really have liked the start system and the jump start system.
I think we need to talk real briefly about the start and jump start system, just if people are not familiar with them, especially people abroad who use different types of triage. And with the start triage system, you know, we're looking at the first thing we do is, okay, and I want to revisit this a little bit later on because it may not always be the right thing to do in a motor vehicle crash situation, but you take all your green, you know, you walk in and say, okay, who can ever get up and walk, get out, and those are going to be your walking wounded. Those are going to be your greens. And then who's ever left in there is basically going to start off at yellow because for some reason they couldn't walk, they couldn't get out. So if right then we move into the aspect of looking at respirations, perfusion, and mental status with that. You know, come up to them, you know, are they breathing? If they're not breathing, open the airway. If they start breathing again, you red tag them, you move on to your next patient. So as soon as you figure out they're a red tag, you stop what you're doing and move on. If you come up to them and, you know, they are breathing, you go ahead and look at if their breathing is more than 30 times a minute. Now, mind you, this is for adults. We have Dr. Liu talk in a second about pediatrics. But, you know, if it's above 30 for, you know, an adult, you're going to red tag them. If you get into them and they're breathing on their own, it's below 30, move on to perfusion status. And some places have talked about capillary refill. Well, I'm not real big on that because where Rick and I live and, you know, Chris, you know, up north, you know, in a cold November, December, January, February day, capillary refill is pretty much going to be useless to us. So we more go along the lines of a peripheral pulse. Do they have a peripheral pulse? If they do, I should say if they don't, we red tag and we move on. If we move into a peripheral pulse and they have it and it's present, we move on to mental status. Can they follow simple commands? My favorite one is show me two fingers, you know, on that. And if they can't do it, they may be altered. We red tag them. We move on to the next patient. If they can show us two fingers, they basically default to yellow. Now, pediatrics is going to be a whole different world. And Dr. Liu, I'll let you go ahead and take that.
Jumpstart basically obeys the KISS principle and follows the same framework as START does. And keep in mind that very rarely are you going to have, if you have kids involved, rarely are you going to have an all pediatric scene. So whoever's doing the triage is going to have to be able to flip back and forth between doing pediatric and adult triage. So it's great if you have one system that just sort of branches out to cover both. So for the kids, the approach is still the same. Still the same thing as anybody who can get up and walk, get up and walk. But keep in mind with the children that children, A, may not be able to walk on the best of days, or B, are so portable that the adults may pick them up and take them with them over to the green triage area. So therefore, A, for those patients who can't walk on the best of days, you can't automatically make them at least a yellow or, you know, a delayed patient just because they're not capable of walking developmentally. So you've got to be able to handle them and not doom them to, you know, stay out of the green area forever. And then secondly, for those patients who are picked up and carried over to the green triage area, they've not yet been triaged because they haven't shown that their physiology is such that they can coordinate the massive effort that it takes to be able to get up and walk someplace. So any children who are carried to the green area still need to be triaged as soon as personnel can get over there. So then for those patients who are left on the scene that have not gotten up and walked off, first you have to figure out, are they a pediatric patient or are they an adult patient? And, you know, we know that we've all seen 12-year-olds who look like they're 18-year-olds, and then we've seen 96-year-olds who are as little as, you know, 13-year-olds when it comes to weight. So to try to assign an age cutoff between start and jump start is a little bit difficult because it can be difficult to assign an age to a patient who just can't say, okay, I'm 13 or I'm 16. So for the purposes of jump start, after looking at side-by-side ratings of start and jump start and sample scenarios, it's very likely that in that sort of teens and tweens age group that chances are both systems are going to triage them the same. So what I've started to say is that if you come to the patient and they look to you like a quote-unquote young adult, then you start. If they don't look like they're old enough to be a young adult, then you jump start. And most likely the decision is going to come when those kids start showing obvious secondary sex characteristics. So, you know, girls who start to have breast development, guys who have facial hair, generally, you know, you're going to be able to make that cutoff between pediatric and adult and using jump start and start. So if you come up to a child who was not able to get up and walk, check and see if they are breathing. If they are not breathing, just as in start, you open the upper airway. If they start to breathe, you tag them as red and move on. If they don't start to breathe, here is where we take into account the unique pediatric physiology. Children, we know, generally die respiratory deaths. They stop breathing, and then their hearts stop after a while because they become anoxic and they're so damaged that they stop beating. That's different from adults who generally will stop breathing because their heart stops beating. So it's possible to have a child who is not breathing but who is still in that position where their heart hasn't become irreparably damaged. And if you can start their breathing again, it's possible that they may be able to sustain those spontaneous respirations for at least a while and be able to, you know, possibly be salvageable. And I call these children being in the quote-unquote window of salvageability. And this is where the jumpstart comes in. If we want to detect those patients who are not breathing but who may still have some circulation, you're going to look at that apneic patient who did not start breathing when you open the upper airway, and you're going to check for a pulse. Now, ideally, I would say check for a peripheral pulse because that's going to indicate more quickly that there's some compromise in perfusion. But studies have shown that some providers, both lay people and medically trained people, can have difficulty feeling pulses in kids. So right now, I'm not going to be picky. I just say get familiar with finding a particular pulse, any pulse you want to, in a child. Get comfortable with that pulse and feel for it. If that child has a pulse, then what you're going to do is you're going to assume they're in that window of salvageability, and you're going to give 5 rescue breaths. Not with a bag valve mask, just with a barrier device. I'm not advocating that triage officers carry around a BVM, but just a barrier device to protect yourself and the patient. Give 5 ventilations. It is a lower airway opening maneuver. I call it a ventilatory trial. If the patient does not start to breathe after you give the 5-breath ventilatory trial, then chances are, unless somebody stays there and ventilates them, their circulation is going to die out anyway. So that is a black tag patient. So if they don't start breathing after upper airway movement and they do have a pulse, you do the 5-breath trial. And that is a jumpstart part of jumpstart. If they start to breathe, you red tag them. If they do not start to breathe, you black tag them. If they haven't started breathing when you open the upper airway and you do not feel a pulse, that's a black tag as well. And that gives us the advantage of going back to the training that the majority of us have had for the majority of our careers, and, you know, check are they breathing and then check for a pulse. And it also gives us a chance to go that little bit of an extra way that we all want to do to try to take care of kids. So that's the jumpstart part of jumpstart. If they are breathing when you come up to them, then where START would say to look for whether the respiratory rate is greater than or less than 30, the respiratory rates change. And I have not just one limit, but an upper limit and a lower limit, because it's actually worse for a child to be breathing too slowly than it is for them to be breathing too quickly. So our decision thresholds are going to be 15 and 45. So if a child is breathing less than 15 times a minute, that's a red. Greater than 45 times a minute, that's a red as well. Between there, then you go on and assess perfusion. Now, if you look back and you're doing combined adult and pediatric triage, then the respiratory thresholds become 15, 30, and 45. So I originally started out 15 and 40, but then I said, hey, dummy, you know, make it easy. Multiples of 15, so 15, 30, and 45 for the combined algorithm. Go ahead.
Now, I just was at a conference and received some literature from New York City where they're looking at doing it, and they actually took the breathing to 10 and 30.
Yeah, I just saw that.
A little concerned about that.
Well, not having talked to the group to know where they got those numbers, I can't say. You know, my numbers were relatively arbitrary. Their numbers, I think, probably are similarly based on opinion and experience. I know several of the folks who are involved in developing that triage system, and I'm sure they've got their reasons as well. Now, the problem with 30, in my mind, is, you know, I'm always trying, surprisingly, to avoid over-triage, because we've got to recognize that over-triage is not necessarily a good thing for the patient. If you're talking especially about a young child who is over-triaged, let's say a 8-month-old who is triaged as a red because he's breathing 40 times a minute, which can be perfectly normal for an 8-month-old to be breathing 40 times a minute. So on a good day, he might be triaged as a red just because he's breathing appropriately for his age. Now you take that 8-month-old who may not be seriously hurt, and because he's a red, he has an increased chance of being separated from his family. He has an increased chance of being tied down to a backboard, being stuck for an IV, and having oxygen shoved on his face. And those are not necessarily benign things for that patient. Over-triage is not, you know, necessarily the best thing to do. So, you know, I in putting together Jumpstart, try to some degree to reduce some over-triage. Is that the right thing to do? Which is better, 30 or 45? I don't know. But I do know that there are a lot of kids out there who breathe more than 30 times a minute on a good day. So who's better, mine or, you know, the New York system? I don't know. You know, that needs to be studied at this point, and it has not yet been studied. Should we go on with the algorithm?
Absolutely. Go ahead.
Okay. So 15, 30, 45 for the respiratory rate. By the way, we're going RPM, respirations, perfusion, mentation. And remember, in the adults, it's RPM 30, 2 can do, 30 being respiratory rate, 2 being cap refill. If you use cap refill, can do being obeys commands. So then if we want to look at perfusion for kids, my preference is to use pulse palpation as well, again, because of those problems with the environmental influences on capillary refill, although cap refill is probably more reliable in general and certainly in a serial fashion in kids than with adults, just because they don't usually have peripheral vascular disease. But I've chosen to use palpation of pulses, palpation of peripheral pulses preferably, and don't make me say that 5 times fast. So if you can feel a good solid pulse, then that's good. Good means that you move on to the next assessment. If there's not a good strong peripheral pulse or whatever pulse you choose to use, then that's red. You know, it's bad. Bad means red. So then if they have a good palpable pulse, then you move on to mentation. Now, can you imagine trying to use obeys commands on the majority of 2-year-olds in the world? The majority of 2-year-olds would be triaged as reds. Who are the last people that you want in your red triage and treatment area? I don't think it's a bunch of screaming 2-year-olds.
Yeah, 2-year-olds.
Right. So it's not a very good screen for mental status for kids. So what I've done is to use AVPU, you know, responsiveness to, are they alert or responsive to verbal, responsive to pain or not responsive at all. And it's basically based on the best motor response. But in general, if the patient is alert or responds to verbal stimulus or responds appropriately to pain. And here's a little tricky part as I break up the pain response. Responding appropriately to pain means localizing that response. So if you pinch somebody's fingernail or finger, they should either pull away or try to push you away. That's called localizing the response. And that's a good survival response. And in general, my theory was that those who are still of the mental status to be able to localize pain probably have enough mental status to be able to protect their own airway. So if you are alert, not alert, but responsive to verbal stimulus, not responsive to verbal stimulus, but appropriately responsive to pain, you've gone all the way down to the end of the algorithm, and the biggest problem then otherwise is that you can't walk, then that's our yellow pediatric patient. If the patient is inappropriately responsive to pain, meaning doesn't localize but sort of has a generalized sort of writhing or moaning response, if they posture or if they're truly unresponsive to painful stimulus, then those are deemed red for mental status purposes. So to be able to be a yellow, you have to not be able to walk. You have to be breathing, but in a decent range. You have to have decent peripheral perfusion and enough mental status to be able to potentially protect your own airway. So that's how I view the overall algorithm for Jumpstart. Now, for those patients who ordinarily can't walk because they are too young or they're otherwise developmentally or cognitively incapable of doing it, or, you know, maybe they had the unfortunate circumstance of having broken their leg, you know, a week before the crash, here's what I suggest to do for those patients. Take them all the way through the Jumpstart algorithm. If they get all the way down to yellow, if they meet any red criteria, they're still red. If they go all the way down to yellow, what you're going to do is a quick external survey to look for significant signs, for signs of significant injury. So that would be penetrating injuries, large tissue avulsions, circumferential burns, substantial amputations, those kind of things. Then they get to stay a yellow. If there are no significant external injuries, then they can be a green, even though they can't walk. And it's just because they're not old enough yet to walk, or you know, they have some kind of a disability that makes them not be able to walk. So that's what I call the modification for normally non-ambulatory patients using JumpStart.
Now, New York has actually gone to the point of saying if you have an infant, no matter what they are, they're automatically red.
I saw that. You know, it's kind of hard to criticize the folks who really want to prioritize the care of children. And because the infants in particular are the ones that folks have difficulty assessing, the ones who are requiring more more personnel, because it's difficult for one person sometimes to take care of a child because, you know, there's just so many more demands. They're very personnel intensive and resource intensive. And then there's just the emotional impact of having injured young children, particularly on scene. Some people feel that the faster that those children get off scene, the better it is for them because they get more expert care and the less emotional burden is left behind on the disaster scene for the providers who are already working in a very stressful environment. And, you know, certainly the general consensus and a recent poll by the American Academy of Pediatrics and Save the Children, the majority of Americans feel that children should preferentially receive treatment and transport and access to resources in precedence over adult patients with similar injuries. So it's kind of hard to argue with giving the kids some precedence. I think that there is such a thing as over-treating kids who may not absolutely need it and creating additional risk and discomfort and stress for them. But, you know, it's just hard to criticize somebody who wants to do more.
Absolutely. I know in this area, in parts of New York, we use a commercial system called Smart Triage, and that uses the Smart Tape, which is, I believe it's based on the pediatric triage tape out of the UK.
Yes. Yeah, it is. The pediatric triage tape is similar to a Braslow tape, where you're supposed to lay the tape down next to the child, and on the tape are the threshold vital signs for, you know, that particular size, which translates to age of child. So if you reach spot X on the tape, here are the vital signs where, you know, if your respiratory rate is above this, then you're a red. Whereas if you're longer and older, then it's a different respiratory rate threshold. So it just, I think it's three different thresholds for length there. My problem with that is that it's a piece of equipment to carry around, and it's also difficult to apply it if the patient isn't laying flat out straight on their back.
I think that's my point, is if the tape should really read, if you can lay this down next to the kid, they're red.
Yeah, it could be.
You know,
if they're laying that still.
Yeah, if kids laying that still on the ground, there's probably something else wrong beyond that.
And now, of course, everybody on a casualty scene is laying flat on their back, and they're not crunched up in the wreckage and stuff like that, right?
Wait a minute. In my EMT class, I was taught to do patient assessment with a patient lying supine on the floor in the middle of the room. Isn't that how all patients are?
Of course.
Rick, Chris, any use of start or jump start triage?
Well, sure. I'd like to jump in for a minute if I could. First of all, I have to agree with that. I think the consensus that we've been talking about is we really do need a system. And with all due respect, I really don't care what system that is. But we've got to have a system of organizing our thoughts in these chaotic situations. If we are going out to deal with, you know, especially pediatrics, kids involved in a mass casualty event, we've got to have a way of centering ourselves and getting us all on the same page. And I think most people would agree that, you know, EMS folks dealing with pediatric calls in general find it a fairly stressful event. And then you add in the mass casualty or disaster situation, it brings even more pain and suffering to the responder, if you will. So having a triage system like JumpStart, I think, allows us to focus on what we need to do and keep those priorities in mind that Dr. Romig was talking about, and doing that extra step for the kids as far as taking care of their airway. And I think this goes a step further, though, in giving us the ability to track patients by, you know, location, because our triage system allows us to get an idea of where they've gone once they've left the scene or to a secondary triage or patient collection point. And it also gives us an opportunity to track change. And I think that's very important in the multi-patient event or the mass casualty event, when we may not be getting people off the scenes right away, whether or not they're getting better, getting worse, or those types of situations. That's why I really feel strongly that we need to have a system and not just be out there kind of free form and doing our own thing. I'd like to have something that gives me that memory cue that's going to help keep me on track when the bad thing happens. So I really do appreciate these systems.
And, you know, it's really important to recognize that triage is a dynamic process. And Jumpstart, Start, the other tools that people talk about as MCI triage tools are only primary triage tools. That's just the first step. You know, there is no standardized tool out there for secondary triage where you've done your initial sorting. You now have a chance to sit down and gather more data about the patient, do a more thorough physical exam. There are no guidelines for that. And a lot of agencies use their local trauma triage criteria if they even have a trauma system. And otherwise, that's where you go on experience. And it's in that secondary triage area where you probably want the folks who have the most experience to be able to, you know, sort out, you know, who's a red or red and who's an orangey kind of yellow or a greenish kind of yellow. So even though we have these objective triage tools to start out with, it's in that secondary triage stage where, you know, we don't have as much guidance. And I would argue that that's probably the area where we need a lot more guidance than anything that's out there. And I'd also like to, you know, echo your comments about these tools really being helpful for the providers as well as for the patients. And that was one of my primary considerations in putting Jumpstart together, is knowing the stressors of bad pediatric calls on EMS providers and personally dedicating myself to doing whatever I can to see that nobody else leaves EMS because of a bad pediatric call. But Jumpstart, I feel, gives an EMS provider who's doing triage the ability to say, if they have to black tag a child, that it is the system that is dictating that that child be black tagged. It is not their personal decision. It is the system that is making the decision, and they are working within the system. And I think it helps to take a little bit of the emotional burden, certainly not all of it, but a little bit of the emotional burden, and may even be able to preserve the ability of that provider to be able to continue on, finish the triage job, and then move on to the next job, you know, within that catastrophe.
I had the great place right there just to take a quick break for a second. We'll be right back to talk about triage with Dr. Lou Romig, Rick Rosati, and Chris Kaiser after these messages.
Do you cringe when getting a call for a kid? Are you uncomfortable assessing and maybe treating kids? Heck, are you uncomfortable holding them? Well, join us over the PDU podcast, PEDI-U.com, to learn about the latest in out-of-hospital care of the pediatric patient.
And we're back to the first few moments. Thank you for staying tuned in with us. And we're talking about triage. We're talking about various triage systems that are out there. We've been talking about Start, Jumpstart. We've talked about Smart Triage, the pediatric triage tape. There are some other ones that are out there, and I know one that comes up is the Seiko triage method, which Dr. Lou, you're familiar with.
Yeah, Bill Sacco is this master mathematician, award-winning mathematician, who first started developing triage systems with the U.S. military, and it's actually in the U.S. military and his work with them where the RPM approach was actually developed, at least in United States triage. And then Bill Sacco was also involved in the evolution of the revised champion trauma score. Bill has taken data from hundreds of thousands of patients in a Pennsylvania trauma registry and done some mathematical wizardry looking at the way those patients presented and then being able to carry it all the way through outcome release from the hospital, which is the only time that outcome data has actually driven an MCI triage tool. And in his mathematical manipulations has determined, again, that the RPM approach is the correct way to do it, and has developed a numeric system that breaks the mold of the four-color triage and breaks it out into actually 13 different numbered triage groups. You assign a score to each patient based on their respirations, perfusion, and mental status. And it's a numerical score. And how those numbers add up is what your triage designation is. So your triage category may be a 6, or it may be a it may be a 12, or it may be a 4. And the the lower your score is, the more critically injured you are. The higher your score is, the less critically injured you are. And then taking this data and doing a lot of complicated analyses has come up with a number of algorithms that say that, you know, those patients who we ordinarily would say are kind of a reddish yellow maybe should be the first off the scene because they have a higher salvageability only if they get to the hospital first. And those high red patients may have low salvageability even if they do get to the hospital. So it sort of breaks through that thing that the sickest patients have to go first, because it may actually be that dedicating the resources to the patients who are a little less sick but more salvageable is going to be the wiser expenditure of resources. It really is a different way of looking at triage.
Wait,
and
what?
It's been a little hard for some people to grasp just because it is so different from what we're used to. One of the objections to SECO triage has been that the company has put together a proprietary software tool that once all the patients have been triaged, you feed the data into the computer. You also then feed into the computer the resources that are available to you on scene and within the community. And then the computer tells you, okay, in ambulance one, put a number 8, a number 6, and in ambulance two, put this number and that number. And it actually gives you not only, you know, who goes first, but how you should group them so that the outcome is maximized. And it's a really complicated thing. The objection to the proprietary tool has been, okay, well, now we got to spend money on the computer programming and on the training. But through my work with Sacco and his company ThinkSharp, they've enabled me to be able to distribute their cards that say how to do the RPM scoring for no charge, which previously that was not available. You had to purchase the training. And because of my dedication to not being proprietary when it comes to kids, they allow me to distribute that via my website at jumpstarttriage.com. So it is available for anyone with the training, and I would encourage people, you do need the training to be able to do this accurately, that you could do this without the computer software. And there is a suggestion that if you know, if your time to clear the scene is 1 hour or less, then here's your first priority numbers, here's your second and third priority numbers. Whereas if it's going to be longer to clear the scene, these numbers are now first priority, these are second, these are third. And, you know, at least in the studies using drills, it's very easy to remember. It's reproducible from person to person, which a number of studies now have shown that start-like systems are not reproducible from person to person. Everybody, even though they think they're obeying the algorithm, does it differently. The studies show that using SACO, it is reproducible, it is dependable, and it does get the sicker patients or the more appropriate patients off the scene first. So I've gone on record as supporting the institution of SACO triage. I do not get any financial advantage from them. I do get the satisfaction of being able to participate in the advancement of triage science, and that's it. But I think it is the way of the future, and it is based on data. It's the only one that's based on data. And I think we really need to be looking at it and putting it to use so that we can look at it and validate it in not a retrospective looking backward fashion, but in, you know, in actual use and looking at it in calls that happen from here on out.
Rick, you had a question?
Well, I'd like to jump in with a couple of questions, Dr. Romig, if you don't mind.
Sure.
Specifically now, bringing this around to training, we all know there's not a whole lot of time dedicated in the EMT basic curriculum to teaching triage. What suggestions would you make to change the system, or how would you train basic EMTs to do triage if you could just wave your magic wand and have anything you wanted?
Well, first of all, let me ask, what triage are you talking about? Are you talking about, and keep in mind when we're talking Jumpstart, Start, SACO, and that kind of thing, we are in general talking about resource-constrained environments. Are you talking about everyday triage with just multiple victims and slightly stressed systems, or truly stressed and restrained environments?
Let's keep it simple. Let's talk about the, if we can use the word, the average multi-patient event involving kids.
Oh, goodness. You know, I think we always have to talk about patient needs and available resources, okay? So the providers who are doing the triage need to have some kind of an idea about where the best resources are for taking care of kids of different levels of injury. And we'll assume injury at this point, and not medical, because keep in mind that all the systems that we've been talking about so far are based on trauma, not medical things like, you know, biochemical stuff and biological stuff. If the providers know what the resources are, then they know if there are pediatric capable resources close, or if very severely injured patients are able to go directly to a more removed resource, perhaps by air, or are they going to have to go to a closer resource and then potentially be transferred out to definitive care? Because as they make those triage decisions, they're going to need to be thinking about who do I need to be getting on the way here to pick up these kids. So it's a really complex decision. Because you got to be thinking about, all right, this kid may need to go far away, so I may need to keep him here on scene longer to wait for the transport that can get him to the best place to start with. See what I mean?
Yeah, I think I do follow you, and that makes perfect sense. And I guess a kind of a follow-up question to that is, you know, talking about the new EMT or the medic going through school is one thing, but how about us more seasoned folks? How do we stay sharp, or what do you recommend that we do to stay sharp and generally taking care of kids in or out of that MCI situation? How do we stay sharp on our pediatric assessment tools?
Well, you know what I always say is that to be good in a disaster or in an unusual circumstance, you have to be good at the daily stuff. So if you don't have much contact with kids on a daily basis in your practice setting, in your medical practice setting, then, you know, you really need to try to seek out more contact with kids. And you can't find out what's abnormal until you know what's normal. So even if it means that, you know, you just, let's say your family has kids and maybe call up your kid's pediatrician and see if you can hang out at the office a couple hours a few times. And just hang out around kids and people who work with kids all the time. And, you know, just pick their brains and be around kids and say, okay, that looks normal, that doesn't look normal. You know, I have an open invitation for folks in my system to come and spend time with me in the ER, just because there is no substitute for just being around kids, so you can just absorb it. Because, you know, with 6 to 10% of all EMS calls being for kids and only 10% of that 10% at most being really, you know, kids who need real ALS intervention, it's just not really common to have a really sick kid or badly injured kid in front of you for any particular given, you know, EMS provider. I think otherwise, to stay sharp with assessment, there's just no substitute for being around kids. But the other thing is that you've got to conquer your mental block about thinking that you cannot be confident working with kids. Kids are not small adults. Yeah, you know, that's been the battle cry for pediatric emergency medicine since we started up about 30 years ago as a subspecialty. But I think we really shot ourselves in the foot, because that created the impression that, oh, you need a whole new database for kids, because, you know, nothing that you learned about adults can be applied to kids. And that couldn't be more wrong. I would say probably 70% of what you know for adults can be applied to kids. And where there are differences, there are critical differences. And it's those critical differences that you need to know, like the critical differences in what kills kids. It's respiratory, generally not cardiac. Like some of the critical cutoffs in vital signs. Is it more important that you count a respiratory rate, or is it more important that you look at work of breathing. What are the ways that you can tell that a child is compensated versus not compensated? And you know, Kyle's very familiar with the fact that I'm a big advocate of using the pediatric assessment triangle, and particularly using that general appearance as the indicator for a child who's able to get good oxygenation, ventilation, circulation, and glucose to their brain or not. If they're still interacting well with the environment, then all those things are happening. And if they're not interacting well with the environment, something is wrong with at least one of those functions. And if there's something wrong with the general appearance, then that child is physiologically sick and we need to hop on them pretty quickly. But there, you know, there's just no experience like being around the kids. So if it means you need to go to a pediatrics office, if, you know, go and hang out at a daycare center, practice on each other's kids. You know, my best friend's a paramedic, and I think all of his kids grew up with permanent dents in their tibias where intraosseous should be inserted. So take advantage of any experience you have to be exposed to kids in a normal setting. And the more you know normal, the easier you'll be able to recognize the abnormal.
Well, I'm so glad you said that. I've got five kids here at home, and at any given time, my house is a pediatrician's office.
Oh, yeah.
And thankfully, though, we get to see much more normal than abnormal. And I do really thank you for saying that there is that correlation that we can draw on between kids and adults, and that kids are not just some special subset of their own. There is some knowledge we can draw on from our experience with adults. And I think that takes the edge off a little bit if people would recognize that. But we have been told for so long that the kids are not just little adults. And I think that sets us up for even more stress because we don't reinforce that statement with a whole lot of training for basic EMTs. And in many situations, even for new paramedics, don't get a lot of reinforcement on managing pediatric calls. So I thank you for taking that stance.
Yeah, it's my pleasure.
I think the other, you know, looking at all this and stuff, and I think we'd be remiss by not looking at the last one I want to talk about is the salt triage.
Salt triage. Anybody else know? Okay.
So salt. Many out there. Well, it's kind of funny. I believe it was Tim Noonan sent me or Nick Nadell, one of the two, sent me a email today when I talked about this was going to be our subject, and he said, "Are you going to talk about salt triage?" I said, yeah, he said, "Do you have something to send to me?" So he sent it to me, and guess what it is? It's yours, Dr. Lou.
Well, no, it's not. Let me tell you what
comments
salt is.
They're comments by you regarding the salt
okay.
triage.
All right. Well, just for folks who may not know, salt triage was developed by a group based on one of the grant projects within the CDC. It's very similar to the recent consensus guidelines for regular trauma triage. This was the group that put together a multi-casualty triage tool that is meant to cover all ages. Salt triage now, after having been first proposed as triage, quote-unquote, guidelines, now have evolved after a lot of talk into a set of model uniform core criteria. That paper has not yet been published. Should be out within, I think, the next year at least. But what SALT now is, what it has developed into, is a framework of points that the consensus group figures that all MCI triage tools should include and address. So they're set in saying that SALT itself is not a triage tool, which I slightly differ with them on that and have not hesitated to notify them of that. But it's a set of guidelines in which they want every triage tool to conform to these guidelines. So for SALT triage, it basically, when you have a multi-casualty scene, what you're supposed to do is come onto scene and break people up into three different groups. And it's a little different than our, you know, triage that we're used to. So people who can get up and walk, get up and walk. And then the people who can't get up and walk, what you're supposed to do is tell all of them to wave their hand. Okay? So the people who wave their hand are sort of your intermediate groups. Those who do not wave back on command are in your first group that you're going to assess. So the people that did not wave are the people that you're going to go and individually assess. So you've group assessed first, then you go to individually assess the non-wavers, and then those who waved but couldn't walk, and then those who walked. So then I need to – wish I had the algorithm in front of me. But basically then, back to the process, just so you know, just a little background. What they did when they pulled these guidelines together is they looked at all the triage guidelines that were out there and saw that none of them have been validated in research, but then figured that they would take what by their consensus would be the best parts of each one and then create a conglomerate tool that incorporated bits and pieces of all these other ones. So, for example, the SALT guidelines include giving two rescue breaths to any child who is apneic. Okay, so that's what they picked out of Jumpstart. Then they picked something out of START. They picked something out of the other tools. So it's kind of a conglomeration. And I have gone on record and will be on record when that article is published as supporting putting the SALT guidelines out there and starting to examine them in a real life setting so that we can see if they are the way to go. You know, I want to move forward. I advocate research and I advocate putting things to practical use. So that's why my name is on, you know, that paper that's going to come out. And I was representing the American Academy of Pediatrics with a couple of other folks. And the AAP has decided to go ahead and also support the further research into SALT and discovering where it will go as far as, you know, guidelines for MCI triage. But anyway, so it takes bits and pieces from the other triage systems, advocates doing what are called life-saving interventions, which would include needle thoracostomy for an obvious tension pneumothorax, two rescue breaths for an apneic child, auto-injector administration in the appropriate setting for those, stopping tourniquets for bleeding, and then goes on. And after you apply those life-saving interventions, then you look and see what the patient's status is. And if it looks like the patient has injuries that the system resources can handle, then you triage them one way. If it looks like it's injuries that the resources are not available to handle, then you go down into the most severe group, but, you know, the possibly non-salvageable group. And I don't have the algorithm in front of me, so I can't give you the absolute details. But it's a little convoluted. It is not objective because it does entail somebody determining, quote-unquote, whether somebody is in respiratory distress without truly defining the respiratory distress. So it needs to be looked at. It is not close to being a tool that I think that everyone should stop and retrain all their folks in. It's just another thing that's out there that we need to be looking at. And, you know, I'm encouraged by the fact that at least now we're getting some attention to that stage of triage, and folks are at least looking at it in entertaining the idea that what we've been doing so far may not be the be-all and end-all. Sorry if that's waffling.
Oh, no, that's not a problem. You know, and I think we have a lot of these methods that are out there. We talked about all different various types of triage methods. We haven't even hit the ones over in the UK with the triage sieve or care flight, you know, triage, and we're not going to get into that too much.
They're all RPM-based. Yeah. They're all same basic physiology.
Yeah, that's definitely, you know, how we're getting into. But I think what we need to do is we have to remember that triage really came out of the aspect of the military. You know, about getting wounded, you know, soldiers in from theater into the ORs and hospital units as fast as they can. But we have to kind of bring this back. We've talked about how there's so many different types of triage methods out there. And now we're going to bring this right back to where we started from, is the multi-patient motor vehicle crash. And, you know, in some areas they may, you know, I don't care what anyone says, unless you've got a whole bunch of ambulances going to the scene all at the same time, it is going to be a mini disaster until everyone else shows up. It may be 5 or 6 minutes in some areas. It may be 15, 20 minutes in other areas. I know areas up in Alaska where it may be 5 hours before they get the people in there to help. So the thing is, and we talked, and Chris, you kind of mentioned this earlier in the pre-show discussion, that do we really even triage? How, you know, we kind of, well, you put it best, Chris. Let me send it over to you.
Well, first of all, sitting here listening to Dr. Romick speak has been like a continuing education system. I've been fascinated with actually learning quite a bit about the triage system that I've used for years. Thank you.
You're welcome.
And as a rural paramedic, my resources aren't around the corner. And as you said, it may be quite a while before I get the resources. And I look at we've said this before. Both the paramedics and the audience have said this before, that we use the system. It's nice to have the system, but we don't always use it. And I'll admit that I've gone on my gut feeling on the triage process before. I've kind of said, yeah, you know what? It looks like a yellow. It looks like a red. And while I've kept the training that I've had on the triage system on the back of my mind, you don't study the various systems enough to memorize all the various numbers that you have to use. And I was listening to you sitting here talking about the SALT system and the other system you were speaking of, and it sounds too complicated for me. I'm going to be called at 3 a.m. to a bus full of children that were returning home from a long-distance football game in my rural area, and it's going to hit an anhydrous ammonia truck, which is something that actually happened in my career.
And the kids were all from a special needs school.
Oh, yeah, and most of them.
And they have hemophilia and HIV.
There you go.
That's the ultimate.
And so I'm going to get out there, and I'm going to be the only paramedic. And it's going to be a chaotic scene. And I'm going to try to remember the mathematician system, and then I'm going to remember the SALT system. And I really like START and JumpStart because, like you said at the beginning of the podcast, they keep it simple. Because I'm stupid when I'm there at 3 in the morning, I'm by myself, and I'm up to my elbows in whatever I'm up to my elbows in. And there you go. The simpler the system is the better thing. And as you said, this is an initial triage system. It's a framework for the initial, I found a patient, I'm making a snap decision what color they're going to be, and then I'm moving on. And as far as the initial system goes, I really like the JumpStart system just because of the simplicity of the whole thing.
I have to agree with you, Chris. And that's one thing in the First Few Moments program, we actually teach START and JumpStart. And I think the one thing is, and we all go on our guts, and I really don't think that we're going to show up to a car accident with four people and say, oh, who can never get up and walk, get out. I don't know if that's always technically appropriate, you know, in that case. You know, the busload of people that roll down the hill into a church, maybe that's a little different. But with the car accident, I hesitate a little bit on that we need to evaluate our patients. And again, it's also depending on, you know, the severity of the other injuries in the car. If I got a person over there who's gurgling, you know, and grunting and respiratory, you know, unconscious and nearing respiratory failure, that guy sitting in the driver's seat that's going, hey, can you get me out? I'm going to be like, get out. You know, that may be the time to do that. But I think the one thing that we don't do well in EMS, no matter what type of triage methods that we use, is we don't really identify the priority. Is that, Chris, you'll show up on scene and you'll triage people, you know, in the car in your mind, then you'll move on to the next car. Then I'll show up to that exact same car and I'll triage people, and Rick will show up. And there's really no identification. And the one thing that we really kind of hammer on and say out there and say is you need to identify these priority of these people. And I don't really think triage tags is all the way to go. I'm not a big fan of the triage tags, especially in motor vehicle crashes, because they're bulky, they're heavy, they're expensive if you have to buy them yourself. I'm more into the colored ribbon.
Yes, absolutely.
Yeah. You know, people can't change their ribbon. You can change your triage tag. If somebody sees that they're green or yellow and the reds are all being taken, you know, taken first, triage tags of today are to the point where you can tear off your yellow and become a red.
Oh yeah, I actually offer people, you know, you want red, it's $100. Yellow's $50. There's actually a T-shirt for sale on the First Few Moments website that says that. By the way,
no way.
Yeah, it's actually on there. It's you know, for sale for that. But yeah, I mean, I think we have to identify folks, you know, and just use the triage tags. And what I do, I teach on top of that, is if you've got a car of, let's say, three people, and let's say you have a green, a yellow, and a red, what I'll do is I'll take the highest prioritized patient and then tag the outside of the car somehow. If there's an antenna, I'll tag the antenna red. If it's on the side mirror of the car or on a windshield wiper, I'll tag it red. So everyone knows that, you know, if we've got three cars, I have one car with a red, one car with a yellow, maybe one car with a green. we know the priority of those cars that we need to send their extrication crew to. You know, we have the, you know, identifying area that when the ambulance comes, they know which car, you know, car to go to. So it just helps with that communication, which, Rick, I'm going to, you know, kind of, you know, volley this over to you, is I think one of the biggest things in terms of mitigating a scene and controlling a scene is communication.
Well, communication seems to always crop up on the top of the list of things that need to be improved in an after-action report, after some type of catastrophic or large-scale event. That's always at or near the top of the list. And I dare say, you know, Chris, you'd probably agree that it's in the top three, if not number one. So being able to send a clear communication message, either verbally or non-verbally, in this case non-verbally by tying off the antenna with a ribbon, kind of helps you direct the flow of resources. But again, we've all got to be on the same page. And that's really why I like Chris's comments about keeping the system simple, not just because we kind of lose our minds or not be able to think in crisis situations, but the best plans, whether it's an incident action plan or a comprehensive disaster emergency management plan, are simple plans so we can utilize them. And I think, Kyle, that's really what you're talking about, is being able to assess a situation, a car, a scene, what have you, direct resources, using it as a force multiplier, if you will, getting the resources where they need to be, communicating that effectively. 100% agree with you.
Absolutely. I think the other thing we cannot forget, And this is where we're kind of wind down our podcast, is training. We need education. We need to learn these systems. We need to learn whichever system you want to do, even if it's the gut system. you know, you have to train on it. You've got to do these over and over again. Chris Montero and I often have a friendly debate about Triage Tuesday. And I'm so against the Triage Tag Tuesday. I think it wastes a lot of money. And I don't really think it's effective or appropriate, because you're not – great, you learn how to fill out a triage tag, but like we said, you know, we don't really use those under primary triage, use the ribbons. I think we need to have scenario-based learning, you know, with that. And going to something that Dr. Liu was talking about earlier, is when you do that that case-based learning and you do those, you know, program scenarios, I think you got to throw in some black tags in there. And, you know, as hard as it is, but I think you need to have some black tags for kids. And we do that in the first few moments, is we'll have a kid, we'll actually have a kid that they've got to make a decision what they're going to do with this kid. And the one of the answers is they tag it black. And it's a hard thing. And we have to be aware of that educationally. We have to be aware of their feelings afterwards, make sure that they're okay, you know, because there is some critical incident, even though it's a fake situation, it still brings some stressors into that.
Yeah. And then go back and make the example or tell the folks, okay, you've chosen to not black tag this kid, which means these are the resources that are going to be, you know, delegated to that patient. Here are your other patients in the scenario. How many of these other patients now have been neglected or possibly died because of the resources that were dedicated to the child who is probably not going to survive in the first place? So you really have to not only point toward what's going on with that patient, but how their actions with that patient influences the rest of the patients in the incident. Because keep in mind, these are the incidents in which we have to be looking at the outcome, not for each individual, not at the primary, secondary triage stage, but the overall outcome for the greatest number of people on the scene.
Absolutely. With that, we are just about at an hour for tonight's topic. I want to thank you for tuning in. I want to thank my crew here with this topic on triage. I found it very enlightening. Mr. Chris Kaiser, where can we find you?
Well, you can find me on lifeunderthelights.com. You can find me on Twitter at CKEMTP. And you can find me on Facebook at Life Under the Lights, at GEMS. You can find me on various podcasts. You know what? Pretty much when you turn on the internet, I'm there. I'm watching you.
It's just disturbing.
He's our big brother.
You know, and that's strange. And I have to say, I've learned a few things tonight. And there's, before we sign off, I have a few things that I'd like to hit here.
Please do.
Because I've been a paramedic for 10 years full time, and I've been working 911 systems since then. And Dr. Romig touched on something I've never thought of tonight. When you mentioned that parents are going to take their portable children, they're going to grab their portable children up in their arms, and they're going to walk to the green triage area. I've never thought of that. that's something that, in my experience, I didn't think was going to happen. When I picture my MCI in my class, you know, they're all lying supine and they're easy to assess. And that's something I think that here, especially in this podcast, we should touch on. The parents are going to move their kids. I didn't think of that.
And they're also not going to leave their kids. So if you try to take the child away from them or them away from their child, they're not going to allow it.
That's a very good point to consider, and something that I think I'll definitely include in my next MCI training class, which you're more than welcome to come up and teach if you'd like.
Love to.
The other issue, and I'm thinking back because it was quite a ways back ago, and I have to say that I've lost it, but I bet you in the closing comments I'll interrupt because I'll remember it again.
Squirrel.
It's my ADOS. It's my attention deficit. Ooh, shiny.
Yes, I think we all have a touch of that. Dr. Lou Romig, where can we find you? Dr. Lou?
Oops. Sorry.
Nope, mute, I tell you.
I was on mute. Okay. You can find me at Lou Romig at bellsouth.net. That's LOUROMIG at bellsouth.net. Or you can get me through my website, www.jumpstarttriage.com. Everything you want to know about Jumpstart is available there for free. You can download the graphics. Anybody can use any of that stuff absolutely for free. You don't need any further permission from me. And all of my other disaster and pediatric lectures are available on the website as well. And again, are open for anyone to use. And I'm happy to answer anybody's emails. And my phone number is even on there. If you're going to call me in the middle of the night with an obscene phone call, please at least make it something that I haven't heard before.
I think in this crowd it'll be pretty easy.
Don't be so sure.
That sounds like a challenge.
Well, and that last voice there is my partner in crime in this project, Mr. Rick Rosati from the Mitigation Journal. Where can we find you?
Hey, Kyle, great to be on First Few Moments and chatting with Dr. Lou and certainly with Chris. And you can find me at mitigationjournal.blogspot.com or Rick Rizad, the little at sign there, and then my name at Twitter and Facebook. And I'm not watching everyone else on the internet. I'm just watching Chris.
Ooh, I'm entertaining.
And Chris, did you think of your comment?
I want everybody to have a great night, and hopefully Dr. Romig's there next time I have to do some triage, because I sure learned a lot this evening.
Oh, absolutely. That, and that's
fantastic.
This was a great episode. Dr. Lou, thank you so much for coming on. And
I'm going to have to get a bigger headset if I hang out with this crowd.
Yeah. And once again, you can find me at Image Medic on Twitter. You can find me on my website, KyleDavidBates.com. You can find me over on my other project, PDU.com, PEDI-U.com. And also, you can find Dr. Lou Romig over there as well. You know, I'll tell you something. We would really like your comments. We'd like to develop more and more podcasts based on what you want to know about the first few moments managing the scene. So give us an email. You can call me, email me at KyleDavidBates@firstfewmoments.com. You can call and leave a message on our hotline at 716-245-5336 or 5FFM as well. Let us know. Hey, you never know. You may end up on the show as well. So some closing remarks here. When you show up to the scene, make sure your scene's safe. Make sure it's established. Go ahead and triage your patients, whichever method that you want to use. But find a method, learn it, and understand why that you're using it. Dr. Lou Romig's got a great website there with jumpstarttriage.com, with a lot of good information. And there's a lot of information on the internet. We'll try to put some of those up here as show notes. But with that said, I want you to remember that safety management, triage, and care are your core components of establishing and maintaining and mitigating a scene. Thank you for joining us, and have a good night.